effort to explain his controversial choice to ally with the Axis powers and raise an army. Every Indian would be happy if freedom could be won by non-violent means, he had said. Bose believed, however, that appeals to the conscience did not work on British leaders, who were determined to retain control and, indeed, to make good their present losses by exploiting India more ruthlessly than ever before. Indians would have to wade through blood to achieve their goals. Father of our nation, in this holy war for India's liberation, we ask for your blessings and good wishes, Bose concluded. Although Gandhi deplored Bose's methods, he could not but admire his devotion to Indian independence. Moreover, the condition in which Gandhi had found India upon emerging from prison had heightened his awareness of the violence structured into a colonial society. He visited Bengal and was heard to wonder why the starving had died in front of overflowing shops but had not looted food. On Christmas Day, 1945, Gandhi journeyed to Midnapore to investigate claims that some of his most ardent followers had committed murder. More than 100,000 men, women, and children lined the canal along which his boat travelled. They stood in notable silence because Gandhi was feeling ill in mind and body and had asked for quiet. Satish Samanta, who had just been released from prison, arranged for Gandhi to stay at a famine orphanage in Mohisadal. The day after his arrival, Gandhi handed his host a signed complaint that he had received from several senior Congress workers. It related the 2-year campaign of extortion and assassination that the Tamluk National Government had conducted. Samanta had been behind bars for most of that period, but after consulting with subordinates, he confessed that the allegations were true. The Mahatma sat as if turned to stone. After a few minutes, Samanta pleaded, "Won't you hear under what circumstances we did these things?" He told Gandhi about the police atrocities. Gandhi asked for proof, and 2 days later his doctor, Sushila Nair, and his granddaughter, Abba Gandhi, went to Masuria. The men of the village were not allowed into the session that followed, but they could hear the wailing from afar. Their pain unfrozen by the empathy of their audience, dozens of women told of the terror and sobbed. "We wept with them," Nair wrote. Kananbala Meti said that she had missed the meeting because her father-in-law had forbidden her to attend. "If you were really non-violent, you wouldn't be here to tell the tale," Gandhi admonished the men of Midnapore. "You would have perished defending them, the women, non-violently." As for the Tamluk government, Gandhi acknowledged that he did not really know how he would have responded to the circumstances it had confronted. "Even violence was preferable to the cowardice of doing nothing," he said. Sushildara, who was anxiously following events from his prison cell, heard the verdict with joy and relief. Gandhi would have been happier if the Tamluk government had stuck with non-violence, but its achievements, he said, were nonetheless heroic. Although he probably did not live to see it, Subhas Chandra Bose's dream of inciting an Indian uprising ultimately came true. News of the Indian National Army's example of valour and sacrifice roused the country to a fever pitch. For the first time since the 1857 rebellion, an insurrection would challenge the loyalty of the sepoys. It was Commander-in-Chief Auchinleck who unwittingly orchestrated the drama that unfolded at Delhi's Red Fort, a towering structure of red sandstone and marble redolent with the grandeur of Mughal emperors and haunted by the bloody ghosts of 1857. In November 1945 at the fort, Auchinleck placed 3 of the INA's surviving commanders on public trial for treason and murder. The men were Shah Nawaz Khan, Prem Kumar Sagal, and Gurbakh Singh Dhillon, a Muslim, a Hindu, and a Sikh, whose religious identities were proof of the extent of Bose's embrace. As the trial wore on, and newspapers avidly reported every twist and turn of testimony, Indians came together in outrage that an occupying power should have the hubris to try for treason men who were fighting for Indian independence. In February 1946, sailors of the Royal Indian Navy struck work and began driving around Bombay, waving Congress flags. The naval mutiny spread to several other ports and ultimately involved 20 ships. Mobs spilled into the streets in sympathy, facing off with the police and the army. The white forces in India were too small to contain a full-fledged mutiny by the military, Auchinleck gauged, and if one broke out, nothing short of an organized campaign for the reconquest of India would suffice to establish control. The courts ultimately found the three INA officers guilty of treason and sentenced them to deportation for life, presumably to the prison and penal colony on the Andaman Islands. But Auchinleck commuted the sentences and set them free. As he explained to furious compatriots, any attempt to enforce the sentence would have led to chaos in the country at large and probably to mutiny and dissension in the army, culminating in its dissolution. For the first time since 1857, India could not be possessed by means of its own army, which meant that it could not be held at all. The three commanders had become household names. They soon learned, however, that the India for which they had fought was not the one to which they had returned. Shah Nawaz Khan appeared at political rallies to plead for unity among Hindus and Muslims. But upon emerging from a Calcutta mosque, he was shocked to find Muslim League supporters stoning his car and shouting slogans favouring the separate nation of Pakistan. So it was that World War II sowed the seeds both for the independence of India and for its division. Independence became an imperative because the raw misery of the war years had sparked rage beyond the colonizers' power to subdue. Division was demanded because by exacting heavy penalties for attacks on imperial interests, the authorities could deflect the fury into internecine bloodshed that would rend Hindus apart from Muslims. During the war, the necessity of containing nationalist insurgencies had led the police to ignore criminals and thereby to embolden them. The same necessity, combined with the need to keep Muslim soldiers loyal, had led the authorities to empower religious separatists. As the British sought an exit from India, their primary concern would be to limit white casualties, and the forces of mayhem would run rampant. Elections held in 1946 revealed the polarization that the war years had fostered. The Muslim League ran on a platform of partition. Before the war, it had failed to get 5% of the Muslim vote, but it now earned 76%. In Bengal, the famine had aided rather than hurt the party's fortunes because the civil administration had relied on workers of the Muslim League and the Communist Party of India to distribute relief. And as the visible faces of succor, both groups had gained traction in rural areas. The Muslim League won the elections in Bengal and joined a coalition of British business interests to form the government there. The former food minister, Hussein Shaheed Surawardi, became chief minister. The Indian National Congress also did well among non-Muslims all over the country, and it won the Northwest Frontier Province as well. In complex negotiations with representatives of the United Kingdom's new Labour government, Congress politicians outmaneuvered the Muslim League and formed a transitional government in New Delhi. Finding himself sidelined in spite of his electoral success, Jinnah vented his frustration in a call for civil disobedience. On August 16, 1946, ominously termed Direct Action Day, Muslims would show that they were serious about establishing Pakistan. That day, at a packed Muslim League rally in Calcutta, Chief Minister Surawardi denounced Hindus and assured the crowd that the police would not interfere in its actions against them. The mob dispersed to burn and loot Hindu shops and to kill. The governor of Bengal, Sir Frederick Burrows, learned that Surawardi was visiting the police control room in Calcutta, allegedly to ensure that the killing could continue unchecked, but Burrows did not intercede. "I had always to consider the susceptibilities of my ministry," Burrows explained to Viceroy Wavell. When desperate residents sought the aid of Calcutta's police chief, D.R. Hardwick, the chief responded sarcastically, Who am I to interfere in your affairs? The Hindus want us to get out. The Muslims want us to leave the country to them. I'm so helpless. Why not ring up the Congress office? Over the next 2 days, while the police stood aside, the criminal underworld, both Hindu and Muslim, stabbed and pillaged until the streets of Calcutta resembled, Burroughs reported, the trenches of the Somme in World War I. There was one reason to be relieved, the governor informed the viceroy. Not a single European had been harmed. A Muslim League official had earlier assured the authorities that the agitation would be directed not so much at the British as at the Hindus, and an editorial published in a Calcutta newspaper on the morning of Direct Action Day had advised Muslims that attacks on British men or women, be they civilian or military, were against the spirit and letter of Islam. As a result, Muslim thugs had turned their fury entirely upon Hindus and Sikhs, and gangs from those two communities had retaliated, spectacularly bolstering the British claim that it was only the Raj that had kept the fractious subjects from one another's throats. Historian Rakesh Batabayal speculates that some such motive lay behind the British delay in calling out the army, which was summoned only at 8 p.m. on the second day of the killings, whereas it had intervened immediately whenever demonstrations or riots had had an anti-imperial tone. The uncontained slaughter in Calcutta, which left up to 10,000 dead in a matter of days, sparked a series of vicious, religious pogroms across India which would make partition a fait accompli. The killings paused for a while, but in October they began again, this time in Noakhali in eastern Bengal. There, a gangster-turned-politician had long tried to mobilize peasants against landlords with no success, until he observed the success of the Muslim League's tactics and inducted Islam as a weapon by which to achieve his political ends. The famine had eased his task, because government propaganda had already convinced Muslim peasants of eastern Bengal that their Hindu landlords were entirely to blame for their hunger. Worse, the wartime reign of the Muslim League in Bengal, in concert with the hostility toward Hindus that emanated from the highest levels of the imperial government, had thoroughly communalized the province's police and administration, both signalling and ensuring that the authorities would deal leniently with attacks on Hindus. Although the army was eventually called into Noakhali, civil servants simply freed the offenders whom the army handed over to them. In the end, the vast majority of victims in Noakhali were not landowners but villagers of the lowest castes, people who had also suffered grievously from famine, as well as from forced evacuations, rape and other depredations by Allied forces stationed in the region. At the time of the strife in Noakhali, Ashoka Gupta was living in Chittagong. The famine had changed her life, turning her gaze out of the home and onto the world beyond. The joy she derived from saving a child by giving her food and shelter and bringing back a smile to her lips was more than she had ever obtained from attending to her household chores. When the pogrom in Noakhali began, she resolved, with the help of the All India Women's Conference, to help the afflicted villagers, and in particular to rescue violated women and girls who were being rejected by their own families after assaults by Muslim men. Gandhi arrived soon after in Noakhali in the hope of bringing calm by trekking from village to charred village. Discouraged by the vastness of her task, Gupta went with a friend to seek his advice and found him living in a burned-down house. Gandhi was in agony. Everything to which he had dedicated his life was falling apart. That religion should be used in service of violence appalled him and challenged the very foundation of his creed. But none of this turmoil was visible to Gupta. To the two women, Gandhi said that it was not enough to visit the ravaged areas. They would have to reside there. Only if we ourselves had the courage to face the dangers of the situation and lived continuously in the villages over an extended period of time, would the local people be assured about our commitment and return to live in their own homes, Gupta recalled him saying. For courage, like fear, was contagious. Just a single example of a courageous deed would act like a beacon of hope and would arouse the bravery and the self-confidence of the local people. With a toddler in her arms, Gupta made a home in the terrifying, ghostly hulk of what once had been a peaceable fishing village. Slowly the killings died down, but things never did return to normal. One young woman confided that she was being taken away every night by gangsters, raped and returned the next morning to her husband. The couple dared not complain to the police for fear of reprisals. Nothing could hush the screams that emanated from Noakhali. The outflow of terror-stricken refugees spreading across Bengal and into Bihar in a desperate search for safety convinced many Hindus that they could no longer coexist with Muslims. Wealthy Bengalis of both faiths began to pack up and migrate to the regions where they would be in a majority. The pogroms of Noakhali sparked even more horrific retributions in Bihar, where Hindu landowners organized mobs to butcher poor Muslims. The toll would reach 20,000. Viceroy Wavell turned down legislators' pleas that killer mobs in Bihar be strafed by military aircraft. Machine gunning from the air is not a weapon one would willingly use, he noted in his diary, though the Muslims point out, rather embarrassingly, that we did not hesitate to use it in 1942. As recently as July 1946, Wavell had ordered the destruction by bombing of villages in the northwest frontier province because some tribesmen had kidnapped a British consul. Compared with his resolve when imperial interests were at stake, the viceroy responded mildly to the far more lethal internecine riots. The director of the Intelligence Bureau had urged that the massacres not provoke the authorities into action which would reintroduce anti-British agitation. If anything, he added, the religious warfare had its uses, being a natural, if ghastly, process tending in its own way to the solution of the Indian problem. Imperial troops should stand aloof, warned the leader of the British opposition, Winston Churchill, and not become the agencies and instruments of enforcing caste Hindu domination upon the 90 million Muslims and the 60 million untouchables. A collection of war-related factors had unleashed violence of a kind that India had not witnessed since 1857, but this time Hindus and Muslims were fighting one another instead of a common enemy, and, after almost 1,000 years of cohabitation, could no longer see how to live together. Both independence and partition became inevitable and were scheduled for August 15, 1947. Gandhi arrived in Calcutta a week before that date and moved into a vacant house with Surawadi, who had had a change of heart, in order to symbolize reconciliation. The Muslims of Calcutta were greatly outnumbered by Hindus and had asked Gandhi to stay in the city, so fearful were they of being attacked. And in return, Gandhi had asked Surawadi to ensure that the people of Noakhali would be safe. That region did remain fairly quiet at this time, a hint of the influence that politicians could wield when they so chose. But in the city the killings went on and on, and a desperate Gandhi began a fast that he intended to end through death. "If the riots continue, what will I do by merely being alive?" he asked in anguish. "If I lack even the power to pacify the people, what else is left for me to do?" Over the next days, as Gandhi began to waste away, the massacres came to a halt. Amazingly, not even murderers wanted his blood on their hands. The weary leader was persuaded to stop fasting. He was now a broken man, lost, his faith in human beings destroyed, mourned Gupta, who witnessed the old man's torment. Gandhi never did celebrate the independence of India, which bore no resemblance to the idyll of freedom and fellowship to which he had dedicated his life. Instead, he left for the Punjab, where the slaughter had reached a staggering scale, hoping to diminish the violence there. Although India and Pakistan had just been born, in part by dividing the provinces of Bengal and Punjab, the exact borders between the nations had not been announced. As a result, blood-crazed men sought to separate the Siamese twins by slashing at the flesh that held them together. The gutters of cities ran red, Murder and rapine emptied entire districts, and trainloads of refugees became trainloads of corpses. The carnage was much the worse in the northwest of the subcontinent, because this region was home to hundreds of thousands of demobilized soldiers. Bands of infantrymen, trained and brutalized by participation in a world war, regrouped into the same clans in which they had earlier fought. The Indian Army used kinship ties to foster loyalty, with blood relatives assigned to the same platoon and men from the same village joining the same battalion. They took the machine guns, rifles, hand grenades, bombs, mortars, signalling systems, and other contemporary technology of warfare they had picked up in distant deserts and jungles, and turned them upon their neighbours. Some even donned their former khaki or olive uniforms. At least 1 million people were killed, and 10 to 15 million displaced. The fearful massacres which are occurring in India are no surprise to me, Churchill declaimed in September 1947. We are, of course, only at the beginning of these horrors and butcheries perpetrated upon one another with the ferocity of cannibals by the races gifted with capacities for the highest culture, and who had for generations dwelt side by side in general peace under the broad, tolerant, and impartial rule of the British Crown and Parliament. I cannot but doubt that the future will witness a vast abridgment of the population throughout what has, for 60 or 70 years, been the most peaceful part of the world, and that, at the same time, will come a retrogression of civilization throughout these enormous regions, constituting one of the most melancholy tragedies that Asia has ever known. Sometime after elections had removed him from power, Churchill had initiated a covert correspondence with Muhammad Ali Jinnah. Speculation abounds as to the contents of the communications between the two men. In one missive dated August 3, 1946, 2 weeks before the carnage on Direct Action Day, Churchill appears to have suggested that Pakistan could in future invade a defenceless India. But since very few of these letters have been found, and because Jinnah left virtually no record of his personal reflections, the extent to which Churchill had continued to influence events in India cannot be properly gauged. Yet even without the evidence the letters might provide, there can be no doubt that if someone more sympathetic to Indians had been Prime Minister during the war years, someone less inclined to derail the independence movement by any means possible, whether through incarcerating nationalists, or inciting separatists, or tolerating starvation, the colony's freedom would have been attained with far more modest loss of life. So it was that the sun set on the British Empire. Turning their backs on a horizon red with flame and blood, Britannica's soldiers trudged toward the ships that would carry them home, some marching to this chant: Land of shit and filth and wogs, gonorrhea, syphilis, clap and pox, Memsahib's paradise, soldiers, hell, India, fare thee fucking well. On January 30, 1948, a Hindu fanatic shot Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi dead during an open-air prayer meeting in Delhi. Chapter 12. The Reckoning. In 1947, Winston Churchill hired a team of researchers and ghostwriters to formulate the definitive history of World War II. As historian David Reynolds has detailed, the treatise was in actuality a memoir of epic proportions, one in which fact often fell victim to selective memory. When Churchill read out loud parts of the history he was writing, Lord Moran, who remembered the events differently, would wonder, could it be that he had come to believe what he wanted to believe? The Bengal famine received but fleeting mention in a document that happened to make it into an appendix. Despite their distortions, the 6 massive volumes became the primary reference for a generation of historians, which may explain why the famine is almost totally absent from the tens of thousands of tomes since written about the war. Behind the scenes, Leopold Amery had done his best to ensure that all the blame for the calamity would fall within India. In late 1943, Viceroy Wavell had faced a vociferous demand from Bengal's politicians for an inquiry into the famine. The Secretary of State for India had advised against any definite commitment to that end. When it became impossible to stave off the inquiry, he had helped the Viceroy select the members of the Famine Commission and to impose specific limitations of kinds of topic which the inquiry is permitted to consider. These would include an avoidance of strategical and other circumstances as may have contributed to internal transportation difficulties or affected HMG's decisions in regard to shipping of imports. Nor was the Commission permitted to summon testimonies from anyone who had since left India, such as Linlithgow. So it was that the Famine Commission, which began its secret hearings in July 1944, would elucidate all the local factors that had led to the catastrophe and avoid every lead that pointed back to London. For instance, although the Commission deplored the policy of food and boat denial, it heard nothing about scorched earth orders issued by the War Cabinet. The Commission also left the impression that only imports of rice, not wheat, would have broken the famine, which was far from having been the case. Nor did it discuss any of the international offers of aid that were rejected. Hints of a cover-up abound. Amery's diaries do not contain any mention of scorched earth, and his papers are missing the pertinent correspondence with India. The testimonies submitted to the Famine Commission were reportedly to have been destroyed, except for one copy that survived as the Nanavati papers. Civil servant Leonard G. Pinnell stated in his unpublished memoir that he had retained his own set of testimonies, but its location is unknown. The unpublished memoir of civil servant Olaf Martin, written sometime after the war, is missing pages that appear to have dealt with his refusal to serve as Chief Secretary of Bengal. "At that time, I had to be careful what I said," Martin recalled of 1943, "just as, at present, I have to be careful what I write." At least one India Office file on rice exports to Ceylon has been destroyed, and another one on Canada's offer of wheat for Bengal is missing. No figures could be located for rice exports from India in the fiscal year 1943 to 1944. In the minutes of a meeting of the Chiefs of Staff, available on microfilm at the National Archives of the United Kingdom, a section dealing with shipping to India is blacked out. The Cabinet Secretary's notes on War Cabinet discussions, which were released in January 2006, stop abruptly in mid-1943, just before Churchill, Cherwell, Leathers and Grigg made their August decision to deny relief to famine-stricken Bengal. Among the papers of Lawrence Burgess, who informally transcribed War Cabinet meetings, no notes on India are available for August 4, 1944, when Churchill's tirade on the colony induced Amery to compare him with Hitler. But other discussions on that date are recorded. References to Subhas Chandra Bose are conspicuous by their absence in War Cabinet minutes, although the assassination order shows how seriously he was taken as an enemy. It also appears that the Famine Commission suppressed the results of a government-sponsored survey on famine mortality. Instead, it provided its own estimate of the death toll, a figure that remains controversial to this day. The Public Health Department had recorded 1,873,749 deaths during 1943. Subtracting from this total the average number of deaths per year, as recorded during the preceding 5 years, the Commission got 688,846 excess deaths during the famine year. This count, the Commission noted, did not include those who had died on the roads or in distant towns during their search for food. The death registration figures were highly unreliable for another reason, however. In Bengal, the usually illiterate village chowkidar collected all such information. One observer had commented that officials of the government of India were very keen on amassing statistics. They collect them, add them, raise them to the nth power, take the cube root, and prepare wonderful diagrams. But what you must never forget is that every one of these figures comes in the first instance from the chowkidar, village watchman, who just puts down what he damn pleases. Even in normal times, a discrepancy of 30% showed up between death statistics collected by the chowkidar and the more reliable figures compiled during decennial census operations. Moreover, thousands of chowkidars were unpaid in late 1941, and given the progressive breakdown in civil administration as war reached India's borders and the Quit India movement erupted, there is no reason to suppose that they were paid in 1943. The chowkidar's salary of 6 rupees a month, plus a special bonus of an eighth of a rupee for helping with cyclone relief, was in any case too low for his family's survival at the prices that prevailed during the famine. Recall that Giribala Malakar of Kalikakundu said that her first husband, a chowkidar, had carried relief materials during the famine and had still starved to death. It is inconceivable that all through 1943 these functionaries were faithfully discharging their manifold duties to the empire. When the Famine Inquiry Committee asked Relief Commissioner Olaf Martin about the registration figures, he replied, "I know that they are exceedingly bad." It is even possible that the figures supposedly compiled by the chowkidars were actually filled in by higher-level officials who had little idea of the toll the famine took, and perhaps little interest in recording a disturbingly high number of casualties. After the famine, Richard Simons, a charity worker, was employed by the governor of Bengal to help with relief and rehabilitation. In an effort to learn the number of children orphaned by the famine, he sent forms around to the district offices. On a subsequent tour, he discovered why the results he'd gotten had made little sense. At the very bottom of the government pyramid, the circular would come to an officer who might be less concerned with accuracy than with the consequences for his career. One functionary might suppose that a small number of orphans would speak to his zealousness in supplying relief. Another might figure that a large number of orphans would lead to generous funds arriving for their support. In sum, the figure either man would put down would be fictitious. Demographers Tim Dyson and Arup Maharatna noted a peculiar pattern in the registration data for West Bengal, the piece of Bengal province that went to India after the partition. During the years 1941 to 1946, the proportion of deaths in certain districts remained exactly the same, a sign that the numbers had been manufactured from the figures for undivided Bengal. Had village-level registration data been available, such manipulation would not have been necessary. Be that as it may, the Famine Commission declared that there was no universal breakdown in 1943 in the system of recording deaths. After introducing a correction for the usual shortfall in death registrations and for roadside deaths, it concluded, "The number of deaths in excess of the average in 1943 was of the order of 1 million, that is some 40% in excess of the officially recorded mortality. We have found no valid reason for accepting estimates in excess of this figure." On the other hand, the high excess mortality in 1944 must be added to the toll of mortality. On this basis, we must conclude that about 1.5 million deaths occurred as a direct result of the famine and the epidemics which followed in its train. Diverse authors have applied equally diverse corrections to the raw numbers supposedly collected by the chowkidars to obtain other estimates for the mortality. Economist Amartya Sen took the registered deaths for West Bengal, extended them to East Pakistan, nowadays Bangladesh, and applied corrections to get around 3 million for the famine toll. Dyson and Maharatna used figures that they unearthed for undivided Bengal, argued that the system of data collection had remained essentially intact during the famine, and got 2.1 million. Intriguingly, Historian Paul Greenough discovered that a careful statistical survey of famine mortality had been presented to the Famine Commission but was never published or publicised. Calcutta was home to one of the world's foremost statisticians, Prasanta C. Mahalanobis, who had founded the Indian Statistical Institute in 1931. By means of exploratory projects in Bengal, Mahalanobis had developed the sample survey, which permits reliable results for the many to be inferred from those for the appropriately chosen few. To that end, he had devised pilot surveys, preliminary studies that help refine the design of the final, exhaustive one, overlapping samples, and other means of reducing error. Mahalanobis would go on to become a Fellow of the Royal Society and to run the United Nations Statistics Bureau. In late 1943 and early 1944, Mahalanobis and his team designed and carried out an elaborate survey at government expense of the famine victims. The researchers interviewed the members of 13,358 households in a representative spectrum of districts and villages to estimate a total number of deaths during 1943 of 3.1 million. This is not the famine toll, as will presently become clear. The death rate in Bengal in 1943 came out to be 5.3%. The worst affected subdivision was Bola in the southeast, with a death rate of 14.79%. The survey had its own shortcomings, but these were precisely defined, allowing for a more solid grasp of the problem than the squishy registration data would allow. To begin with, Mahalanobis did not include the deaths of children less than 1 year old because the respondents were unreliable on that figure. Second, the survey depended on the reports of relatives and so could not account for individuals who were missing, some of whom must have died, or for families that had perished in their entirety. In Kalikakundu, at least one family consisting of Bahari and Duwari Das and their teenage son died out. Third, Mahalanobis did not get to repeat the survey to account for deaths from famine-related disease during 1944 and later. Fourth, and this is the most difficult problem, in order to calculate the famine toll, one has to subtract from the total number of deaths those that would have occurred in the absence of famine. The normal rate of death is very hard to determine because the death rate varies from time to time and from place to place. The mortality rate for India as a whole is believed to have been 2.1 in 1942, but no data specific to Bengal are available. Compared to the politically favoured northwest, the state of nutrition and health in Bengal was miserable, and Mahalanobis assumed a normal death rate of 4% for the province based on the census of 1931. One can gauge the applicability of this death rate to the early 1940s by reviewing how mortality in Bengal might have evolved during the 1930s. The rate of land sales offers strong evidence that economic distress increased all through that decade. This kind of data is reliable because land sales, unlike deaths, had to be registered in order to take effect. The number of land sales in Bengal in 1929 had been 79,929, but the frequency of such transactions increased steadily so that in 1938 the figure was three times as high. The next year, when the war began, the sales doubled and they continued to rise until in 1942 the number was 749,495. In 1943, the famine year, the figure doubled again to 1,532,241. Since an owner parted with land only as a last resort, to save his life and that of his family, these figures indicate that the suffering in Bengal, and in all likelihood the mortality rate, increased throughout the Depression and war years and reached a peak with the famine. The easiest way to begin estimating the number of famine deaths is to picture a pyramid representing a pile of corpses that towers over a flat expanse, as would be the norm. But with the 1943 Bengal famine, one is forced to try and separate a peak from the mountain upon which it sits. Where should a determination be made between the two? What level of mortality should be regarded as normal? It becomes as much a matter of inclination as of science. Beginning with Mahalanobis's figure for the total number of deaths in 1943, Greenough corrected for infant deaths, which were 18% of the deaths in normal times, and subtracted the estimate of normal deaths provided by Sen to estimate a famine toll of 2 million for 1943. To that, he added Sen's estimate of mortality during 1944 and 1945 to get between 3.5 and 3.8 million as the number of deaths attributable to famine. A more consistent approach is to stick with mortality rates for the entire calculation. Mahalanobis's mortality rate of 5.3%, when corrected for infant deaths, yields a total mortality rate of 6.5% for 1943. The population of Bengal in January 1943 was 61.8 million, which gives a total of 4 million deaths for 1943. From this figure must be subtracted 2.5 million baseline deaths, calculated by using the normal death rate of 4% that Mahalanobis preferred. That gives 1.5 million for the famine toll in 1943. Doubling this figure, because death registrations were roughly symmetric around December 1943, provides a famine toll of around 3 million. None of these estimates for famine mortality account for starvation deaths during 1942, although in coastal Bengal, scorched earth and cyclone had caused the famine to begin by at least the last quarter of that year, and it remains unclear how, if at all, Mahalanobis accounted for those individuals and families who had simply vanished. On the other hand, it is possible that the normal death rate was even higher than 4%, which would tend to reduce the famine toll. One thing is clear. The figure of 3 million does not include all fatalities from shortage of food, because deaths from malnutrition were undoubtedly occurring even in so-called normal years. If, for comparison, we were to use the death rate of 2.1% that was the norm for India rather than Bengal in 1942, the famine toll would be 5.4 million. Nor do these figures include famine deaths in the rest of the Rice Belt, such as in Orissa and Madras. In 1949, a session of the Geneva Convention extended the guidelines for civilized warfare and included a prohibition against starving civilians in occupied territories. To the fullest extent of the means available to it, the occupying power has the duty of ensuring the food and medical supplies of the population. It should, in particular, bring in the necessary foodstuffs, medical stores, and other articles if the resources of the occupied territory are inadequate, the convention declared. In 1977, additional protocols strengthened the injunction against starvation, prohibiting the removal or destruction of objects indispensable to the survival of the population. If the application of an economic blockade resulted in starvation, the convention further mandated the provisioning of essential supplies to the civilian population. In fact, depriving civilians of an occupied territory of vital foods and failing to supply them with adequate relief constitute war crimes as understood today. Given that the War Cabinet enjoyed absolute control over shipping to and from India, that tens of thousands of nationalists were in prison, that in the estimation of military intelligence, India was an occupied and hostile country, and that the War Cabinet spoke for Indians by, for instance, turning down offers of grain on their behalf, India was presumed by the United Kingdom to be an occupied territory. If such provisions protecting civilians had been in place before the war, the denial policy and the failure of His Majesty's government to relieve the famine could conceivably have been prosecuted as war crimes. Although the actions of the War Cabinet can be traced with some accuracy, mainly through documents of the Ministry of War Transport, its motives for denying adequate grain to India in the summer and fall of 1943 remain too various and intertwined to tease apart. One reason it chose not to relieve the famine derived from its determination to meet the target of 27 million tons of civilian imports for the United Kingdom. To Cherwell, at least, that meant no ships could be released from the import program. A second reason was the Balkan stockpile, close to Churchill's heart, and also close to Cherwell's, because that reserve could take some of the pressure of feeding liberated Europe off the UK stockpile. A third reason appears to have been the avoidance of embarrassment, as in having to admit to American officials that the British Empire controlled enough ships and grain to send substantial relief to a colony imperiled by hunger. Saving face might seem to be a peculiarly trivial reason for permitting a famine to run its course, but perhaps it was not too trivial, given that the English government deemed the lives of Bengalis to be inconsequential. Churchill's broad-brush loathing of the natives might have added impetus to the other rationales for failing to aid them, as might have the continued defiance of Subhas Chandra Bose, who was wildly popular among Bengalis. The mere existence of the Indian National Army was a source of humiliation to the British because it advertised the fact that armies of subjects in British colonies had chosen to fight alongside the Japanese, whereas the reverse was true in the Philippines, an American possession. The War Cabinet's shipping assignments made in August 1943, shortly after Amory had pleaded for famine relief, show Australian wheat flour travelling to Ceylon, the Middle East and Southern Africa, everywhere in the Indian Ocean area but to India. Those assignments suggest a will to punish. Fiercely evident through almost every War Cabinet discussion on India in 1943 is Churchill's inchoate rage. Rage because the colony was slipping out of his grasp, and rage because in violation of the laws of nature and man, it had turned from being a debtor to a major British creditor. As late as 1947, Churchill would write in a draft of his war history that India was the greatest war profiteer. A similar charge could be made of His Majesty's government. It stockpiled food during famine, and by selling such liquid assets, must have made a considerable profit on the rising market after the war, according to historian R.J. Hammond. Churchill and Cherwell were convinced that for the United Kingdom to owe money to India was a monstrous injustice, and that the colony should be forced to bear the entire burden of war expenses. All the evidence points to the Prime Minister and his closest adviser having believed that Indians were ordained to reside at the bottom of the social pyramid, such that their financial ascendancy as creditors during the war became a source of frustration and fury. Long after India had obtained independence, the Prof would describe the abdication of the white man as the worst calamity of the 20th century, more deplorable than two world wars and the Holocaust. In the end, it is not so much racism as the imbalance of power inherent in the social Darwinian pyramid that explains why famine could be tolerated in India while bread rationing was regarded as an intolerable deprivation in wartime Britain. Cherwell, for instance, did not think much of the British working class either, but he was deeply engaged in feeding it and placating it. Economist Amartya Sen observes that famine has never occurred in a functioning democracy, a form of government that inverts the traditional power structure by making rulers accountable to those whom they rule. If Cherwell lavished attention on British civilians, that was no doubt because all of his considerable power derived from his friendship with Churchill, whose own power and popularity would be tested in post-war elections in the United Kingdom. References to public opinion are frequent among the S-Branch papers. While urging the shipping cut to the Indian Ocean, for instance, the Prof had warned of political repercussions unless his advice was heeded. Remonstrating against promises of food for post-war Europe, he had asserted that if these pledges were fulfilled at the expense of UK rations, we shall be blamed at home. During the war, Cherwell protected Churchill's domestic flank with the single-minded devotion and ferocity of a guard dog. Indians did not vote in British elections. The central evil of imperialism is the inability of subject peoples to hold their rulers accountable, and all the rest, even the racism, may flow from that essential powerlessness. In her classic treatise on totalitarianism, Hannah Arendt distinguished between race thinking, the categorization of humans by perceived characteristics, and racism, the ranking of these categories into high and low. She argued that racism was a direct consequence of imperialism, which would have necessitated the invention of racism as the only possible explanation and excuse for its deeds, even if no race thinking had ever existed in the civilized world. The British imperial need to demonize Hindu males vanished overnight with India's independence, which points to the accuracy of Arendt's observation. One person who emerges from the famine with remarkably clean hands is Leopold Amery. True, he had urged ruthlessness in implementing the War Cabinet's scorched earth policy, had initially hoped that the Viceroy would muddle through without grain imports, and had relayed Churchill's demands for continued rice exports from India. And given that Amery appears to have orchestrated a cover-up, by, for instance, ensuring that the Famine Commission would refrain from discussing shipping constraints and probably issuing the order to destroy certain India Office documents relating to grain exports from the colony, it is imaginable that in some other way, which may never be known, he had aggravated the famine. But after mass starvation was reported to the government, he did urge upon the Ministry of War Transport and the War Cabinet the necessity of sending grain. Amery's willingness to endure opprobrium for the Bengal famine may have been a form of atonement for the actions of his son. John Amery had been in France when the Nazis invaded, and after Hitler attacked the Soviet Union, he had gone to Berlin to offer his help. Convinced that the United Kingdom should oppose the Soviets instead of aiding them, he had tried to recruit his countrymen to what he called a British Legion of St. George that would fight the Russians on the Eastern Front. John Amery was captured in April 1945 and brought back to England for trial. He protested that he was an anti-communist rather than a Nazi, but he pleaded guilty to treason, apparently to spare his family further pain. He was executed that December. At the time, his father circulated among friends a poignant note explaining why John had acted as he did. He had spent so much time on the continent that he thought himself more European than English. He was also rather psychologically disturbed, had a broken marriage, suffered a bankruptcy that he blamed on Jewish bankers, and claimed to have seen atrocities in Spanish concentration camps that had given him a horror of communism. Amery gave him this epitaph. At end of wayward days, he found a cause. 'Twas not his country's. Only time can tell if that defiance of our ancient laws was treason or foreknowledge. He sleeps well. Leopold Amery's patriotism was never in question, but the stanza perhaps hints at his own subterranean affinities. In particular, his deep empathy for Jews, which motivated at least in part his lifelong support for the cause of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. After his tenure as Secretary of State for India ended in 1945, Amery never returned to political life. Behind the scenes, he continued to urge that Britain discourage a partition of India. A secret patron of Israel, he visited that new nation in 1950, where President Chaim Weizmann received him. Amery also embarked on an autobiography. He had written three large volumes without getting much into discussion of the war when he died in 1955 at the age of 81. In the spring of 1949, Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru declared that India would like to remain within the Commonwealth. To Churchill, that meant that the British Empire might endure in spirit, and it thrilled him. Meeting Nehru in London, he said with emotion that he had done him great wrong, hailing the Indian leader as a prodigal who has returned to the fold of the family. Nehru was on his way to Washington, D.C., and Churchill said he would have liked to introduce him to America as having conquered two great human infirmities. You have conquered fear, and you have conquered hate. Churchill was clearly thinking of himself. a tyrant when at the top of a wave, as Beaverbrook had once observed, after the wave crashed, he could be a remarkably introspective man. Now the arrogance and self-assertion have gone, and there is left a deep humility, Moran had observed of him after the Tory loss in post-war elections. The war memoirs turned Churchill into a hero, and in 1951 he was elected Prime Minister. In that capacity, he had cause to interact further with Nehru, with whom he had something in common. They were both graduates of Harrow. These encounters prompted Churchill to revise some more of his long-standing prejudices. When you learn to think of a race as inferior beings, it is difficult to get rid of that way of thinking. When I was a subaltern, the Indian did not seem to me equal to the white man, he confided to his doctor. In June 1953, after witnessing the coronation of Queen Elizabeth, Churchill found himself standing next to Nehru's daughter, Indira Gandhi, while they both waited for their cars to drive up. "You must have hated the British for the treatment meted out to your father," Churchill said. "It is remarkable how he and you have overcome that bitterness and hatred." "We never hated you," she responded. "I did, but I don't now," he replied. Not long after, Churchill suffered a debilitating stroke. Believing that he was about to die, he told Moran, albeit with a great many reservations, that he had been wrong about India. What exactly he regretted, the doctor's account gives no clue. Lord Cherwell suffered no such qualms. He continued to complain bitterly to friends that Indians and Egyptians had defrauded us during the war. After Churchill became Prime Minister for the second time, Cherwell moved into 11 Downing Street, from where he could stroll into No. 10 through an interconnecting door. He was the Prime Minister's advisor on nuclear warfare. From time to time, with what economist Roy Harrod called an expression of extreme severity, the prof would express his profound dismay at the demise of the colonial system. He hated the cold of winter and longed to retire to a warm place such as Jamaica, but he was deterred by his phobia of blacks. Eventually, he returned to Oxford to live in his former rooms and in 1957 died in his sleep. Churchill lived for 7 years longer, slipping inexorably into the sort of depression that had beset him previously in his life. He would sit for hours in front of a fire, brooding on the past. If Winston has believed in anything at all in the course of his long life, it has been in the British Empire and all that it stands for, Moran wrote. Some of his happiest hours as a young subaltern were spent in India, and India was gone. In the memoirs that Churchill had written about the war, he had tried to justify all that he had done, and managed to convince almost everyone of the rightness of his actions. But have there been black hours when he has not been so sure, the doctor mused. There was the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the repulse, and the lives of the English sailors lost in that unhappy affair. And there was... But the mind of the man of action does not work like that. When he has taken a decision on which thousands of lives depend, he puts it away from him. How otherwise could he keep sane? The blank that Moran left in his memoir cannot be filled in until at least the 2020s, when some of his draft manuscripts will be opened to the public. Moran continued, "And yet, when all this is said, my doubts remain. Does the artist, for that is what Winston is, really escape so lightly?" On January 24, 1965, Winston Spencer Churchill died at his home in London at 90 years of age. A month before Indian independence, Sushil Dara was released from prison and came home to a hero's welcome. Asked to address the crowd, he broke down in tears. He cried for the youths he had led to their deaths in September 1942, who had not gotten to enjoy the liberty they craved. Kumudini Dakwa's husband had also been released from prison. He took to travelling extensively in connection with his social work, which led Dakwa to draw ever closer to Dara. When Dara's sister-in-law perished in childbirth, leaving three young children, Dakwa joined the household as their surrogate mother. Dara's last sojourn in prison had given him time to read and reflect, and had turned him back into a Gandhian. Entrusted with all the cash that remained after the Tamluk government's books were balanced, he used it to build a maternity hospital, a venture aided by Chitto Samonto. Samonto also helped Dara with other projects inspired by Gandhi's ideas for restoring self-sufficiency to villages, such as perfecting a formula for soap made of local ingredients. Soon after independence, Samonto walked to a high school owned by Mohisadal Zamindars and, summoning up all his courage, asked to see the headmaster. The great man was seated on a chair mounted high on a platform like a judge and asked in a booming voice what the youth wanted. "Free schooling," Chitto replied. The headmaster glanced over his old grade reports, regarded the young man carefully, and agreed. Chitto would, however, have to pay 5 rupees for the first 3 months, after which his fees would be waived. His brother came up with the money, and Chitto was admitted. All the other boys in the school were from wealthy families and would spend their time smoking and lazing around, but Chitto did not even have the money to buy textbooks. He had an idea. In those days you could get thin paperbacks, mostly biographies, for 25 rupees. Whatever money I could collect, I would spend on buying one of these. I started a library service, would lend to the boys. With the money I earned, I bought more for my library and kept some aside to buy my own books. Chitto also cooked and sold food at fairs. My classmates bought snacks from me and sometimes helped me out at the stall. I used to walk every day from here to Mohisadal and come back the same way. In winter it would be dark by the time I got back. Much against Chitto's wishes, his mother had subsequently arranged his marriage. The angry young man had left home with the idea of becoming a wandering sadhu or holy man. It was Dara who had found him, sheltered him, and persuaded him to return to his bride. "I wronged her," Samonto said in 2005, looking at the woman who had since been his uncomplaining partner. Throughout their long marriage, she worked from dawn to dusk, mopping the walls of the 2-story mud house so that they would not crumble into dust, tending the cows and the vegetable gardens, and later helping her daughter-in-law in the kitchen. In middle age, Chitto Babu, as he came to be known to all, served as the Prodhan chief of Kalikakundu. At the time he acquired government funding for an irrigation canal that now gave the village 3 crops of rice a year. More recently, he had organized villagers to rebuild a shrine for the stone image of Kali that had given the village its name. Even better, his elder sister had saved up all the money she had earned as a nurse and bought her brother a field by the family home. A local landlord gave him another as a gift. Since then, Chitto Samonto, his wife and their children, had been able to grow all the food that they needed and were even able to donate the occasional bowl of rice or an eggplant to their poorer neighbours. Samonto's grandchildren did not work in the fields but had the lightest chores, such as sweeping, because they were expected to study. Samonto's eldest son, Ashok, had planted the field in front of the house with protein-rich kolai peas just for the children to eat. "They can pick and eat all they want," he said proudly. "When the peas are gone, it is the cows who chew the stringy plants that had once helped save his father."
This has been a production of Churchill's Secret War, The British Empire and the Ravaging of India During World War II, written by Madhushree Mukherjee.